Hey, good morning and welcome to Boneheads and Bigots. And I want to thank Jake, who just helped me figure out the difference between blue and green. God, I don't know what my problem was. It's like I keep turning it down and it's still really loud in my headphones. Yeah, I think you learn colors like before you even get to first grade, right? Okay. I want to remind everybody that the Waterfront Blues Festival is coming up next Friday. It goes from the 30th through the 4th, which is a Tuesday. It's a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. So I encourage you to come down there, a couple of cans of food, and I can't remember how much it is, $8 to get in. It's going to be some really great performers there this year. John Hyatt and the Mississippi All-Stars. Dr. John's going to be there on Friday night, and I'm really excited to see him. My good friend Monty Amundsen is going to be here with Boyd Small from Holland, so you got to check that out. Monty just put out a new CD. And, of course, KBOO will be simulcasting that. So if you can't get down to the Blues Festival itself, you can turn into 90.7 and hear it all weekend long. And if you do get down there, be sure and come by and see us at the KBOO booth. Pick up a program guide, bring some money, and buy a cool T-shirt. I know that we always have some of the T-shirts that Kathleen Stevenson designed, which I really like those. We were just listening to Gabor Szabo, and that was off of Kid Loco, Late Night Tales. It's a collection of CDs where DJs just put together stuff that they'd like to listen to when they bring people back to their homes after the club, like at, what, 8 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, we're going to hear some more of that on the way out, but that one is one of the best of that series, so I highly recommend that you pick that up, Kid Loco, Late Night Tales. I got a couple of book reviews today. I've been reading a lot of books lately. I would also like to let you know that our library, our county library, Multnomah County Library, is so amazing. It is such an amazing library. Like, I've just been obsessed with the library lately. I go to the library and I get like 13 books and then I just like hunker down in my house or outside in the backyard and just read books after books after books. One of the books I just read, I highly recommend to you. I forgot the name of the author. I just took it back to the library yesterday. But it's a story of how IBM worked with the Third Reich during the Holocaust using their Hollerith machines to basically, the question was, how did the Third Reich know where every Jew was everywhere in Europe so easily? How could they move trains around to dispatch them to concentration camps and workforces and all that kind of stuff? Well, thanks to IBM and Hollerith machines, that's how they could do it. It's a really chilling story and one that IBM has refused to respond to any questions for years about it. But if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., which I highly recommend, that's a really great museum. It takes a while to get through there. I think I was there for like 3 hours and didn't even get through the whole thing. But I digress. If you go to the Holocaust Museum, there is an IBM Hollerith machine there. The guy who wrote this book, I think his last name is Dixon, but I can't remember, basically wrote the book because he had those questions, you know, how did the Jews get tracked down so quickly? How did the trains move so efficiently? And the Hollerith machines were able to give updated information like in a 2-day span of where all the trains were so they could move them on the lines. Whereas before that, the methods they were using would be 2 weeks, which would be really inefficient if you were trying to, oh, for example, kill all the European Jewry, or if you were just trying to, move people around. So it's a really disturbing book, but a really good read. And it also talks about how IBM in New York was fully aware of what was going on and, in fact, was making sure that they were diverting all of the profits from IBM Germany to New York. And that it's a story in certain ways of kind of science gone bad where they knew what was going on. IBM knew what was going on, but they were really excited to be able to test and use the technology. So I highly recommend that book. Another book that is actually pretty timely with Al Gore's movie out and all of that. And I saw the Vanity Fair about 2 months ago had a big issue on global warming and all that kind of stuff. So that was pretty interesting, pretty mainstream population, I thought, to get that information. But there's a book out called The Republican War on Science. It's by Chris Mooney. that's another book I recommend to you. The impression you get after you read it is that science is definitely under siege. It got published in hardback last September, so I don't imagine that it's out in softcover yet, but it's worth getting in hardback. It's meticulously researched and pretty well written. It's journey through some unsettling interactions between science and politics in contemporary America. Mooney's case is that over the last several decades, conservative and, in particular, Republican activists have sought to systematically undermine and attack the integrity of science in order to advance their own economic and social agendas and interests. And this actually might be one of the fights that the right is very clearly winning. The story goes back to Kennedy-era right-wing anti-intellectualism. And the 1964 Goldwater presidential candidacy, though you could argue that tensions between science and conservatism is at least as old as the Enlightenment. In the 60s and 70s, the environmental and consumer movements were rising, and the resulting government regulation stirred the industry into defensive mode. Money from industry sparked an explosive growth in lobbying business and spawned think tank culture, which became a breeding ground for reactionary conservative ideology and policy development for decades to come. The watershed moment, according to Mooney, was a Reagan presidency that, although it was less brutal in its treatment of science than later Republican administrations, the Reagan administration laid most of the groundwork on which subsequent attacks of science were built. Reagan illustrated the twin political ideas of religious conservatism, and pro-business deregulation. And those two things are the prime motivations of the hostilities towards science and, of course, science's despised cousins, secular intellectualism and liberalism. Now, Mooney, the author, identifies a host of tools and techniques that has been used to assault science, including legislation, regulation, PR, marketing, managerial practices. But the good thing about this book is that he shows how all of these weapons have been absorbed into the Republican war on science, and just as the religious and pro-business deregulation movements have moved into the GOP mainstream. So it's kind of nice to have those connections made. He has a section in the book that's called Battle Damage Assessment, and it runs from minor skirmishes to pitched battles. And reading it right during the time of this war is kind of eerie in a certain way. The body count in this particular battle damage assessment on science is pretty high and climbing. An early and vital victim of this war was Congress's own Office of Technology Assessment, OTA. Mooney describes it as being dismantled by the Gingrich-led Republican caucus. In reality, it was a lot more brutal. The 104th Congress simply chose not to fund the OTA after September 30th, 1995, and that was after it had been funded for 23 years. Now, during that history, the OTA was not a very well-known office, but what it did was it provided congressional members and committees with objective and authoritative analysis of hundreds of complex science and technical issues. So shutting it down or not funding it dealt a double-headed blow, deprived Congress of an important source of objective advice on science and technology policies and implications, and it also closed down a public space where policy could meet science in, what's really important, a transparent and accountable way. Now, the people who are in favor of shutting down the OTA, of course, argue that it'd become an instrument of left-wing anti-business and anti-military interest. So perhaps that could be true at the time, but the reality was it's inconvenient for an office of Congress itself to be producing findings, as it occasionally did at that time, that's inconsistent with prevailing conservative doctrines and policies. As, for example, a 1998 report came out after it was defunded, highly skeptical about the viability of, I'm sorry, 1988 OTA report that was highly skeptical about the viability of Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. Remember Star Wars? Yeah. So anyway, that criticism, I think, was sort of the high point of making sure that the OTA was not going to be funded anymore. And it also did a disservice to the American people, because you have a bigger growth, along with term limits, you have new people in Congress all the time, and they don't have the ability to do the research, nor do they have the time or the funding to do the research. Instead, they're being fed research from these sort of Republican think tanks, which are, you know, outnumbered left-wing think tanks 10 to 1. And so if you don't have the OT out there or a similar office that's providing you with objective analysis of policies and the results of those policies, then you need to talk about something, right? So you're just going to take, you know, the PR that you get and the PR that you're getting from the Republican administration or from Republican groups is not unbiased, objective PR. So there's a lot of really good research in this book. Again, it's the Republican War on Science by Chris Mooney. The interesting thing now is that he documents this consolidation of the anti-science wing in the political right. He shows how over and over again the same strategies have been used. The paradoxically named Data Quality Act and the doublespeak of sound science, deliberately playing up and misrepresenting the nature and extent of scientific uncertainty and debate around lightning rod issues like global warming, the coercion of scientific officials and appointees, for example, the most recent appointees last year at NASA, and the outright distortion and rejection of scientific findings and advice. Mooney explains how these have been applied to issues from tobacco, fishery conservation, dietary sugar, to the teaching of evolution, creationism and intelligent design, and also contraception, abortion and AIDS to stem cell research. Not all these battles have been won or lost, depending on what perspective. They still rumble on, but the war on science that Mooney talks about is a war that the Republican supporters might actually be winning, as I said before. Now, conservatives haven't been the only ones to try and bend science to their agenda. Greenpeace, to cite just one organization, has been guilty of misrepresenting science in fights against genetically modified foods and environmental campaigns. The difference here, though, on the right, though, is that the alliance of conservative, religious, and pro-business deregulation movements is what makes this war on science a very unique Republican phenomenon. Now, in this book, Mooney offers a couple proposals about what could be done. The first is a need to revive or replace the OTA's capabilities. That's not going to be very easy because there have been several attempts to resurrect an OTA-like function through legislative amendments and appropriations, and they've all consistently failed since 1995. Mooney also urges the scientific community to use its own self-defensive efforts. He praises organizations such as the National Academy and the American Association for the Advancement of Science for their moves to engage these issues and try to be more defensive but also more proactive about the issues for debate. Mooney also suggests that those who want to reverse the polarization of scientists and the politicization of science should use every available legal and educational recourse in defense of its integrity. He also calls on journalists to think critically about and do a better job of explaining science to their readership, particularly in the context of controversial policy issues. And I think in some respect I was really surprised when I picked up that issue of Vanity Fair. It's got to be 2 months ago that was all about global warming. And all about misinformation about global warming and how it, you know, has really set America back several years, and other countries are really concerned that we haven't even stepped up to the table and read the textbook. You know, it's like there's a test, and the United States just showed up and didn't even read the textbook. So I think that's one example of journalists to do a better job of explaining what's going on to their readers. But my concern is that, you know, if you're explaining it in Vanity Fair, you might be preaching to the choir, or at least preaching to the people that everybody can afford a Prius for their own kid. So maybe that's not the best audience to be working for. The only thing that's kind of missing in this book is that there aren't any comparisons internationally. You know, it makes you wonder whether this is fundamentally an American problem, like we just have decided that we don't like science and we have a strange, you know, perfect storm of Republican administration and, you know, pro-business deregulation is booming, and that this is the time where we've started to attack science, or are there parallels in other countries? Seems to me like the Thatcher years in Britain were somewhat similar to that. Or maybe the latest conservative resurgence that's happening in Germany. You'd want to know what, you know, what's the consequences of us increasingly being isolated on these issues. It would be interesting, too, to see if there are any other organizations out there in other countries that are like the OTA. I know that there are some European countries have smaller groups that are versions of the OTA, but they're smaller, they're not as well-funded, but on the pro side of that, they're more agile and can respond to other changes a little bit more quickly than the OTA. And that was one of the biggest objections to the OTA, was it was a bureaucratic mess, a behemoth that wasn't quick to move. Now, since this book was published last September, there's been lots of stuff that's been in the news. There's been lawsuits about the teaching of evolution and intelligent design. Stem cell research remains in the news. Extreme weather events that fuel concerns over global warming. That's just a few of the examples. And it's interesting that the president's State of the Union address also talked about the need to invest in science and technology as an engine of U.S. economic competitiveness. Hardly the words of a man who hates science, you think. But at the very same speech, he talked about legislation to prohibit the most egregious abuses of medical research, human cloning in all its forms. I think that single sentence kind of captures the essence of the Republican war on science in all its glory, misrepresenting, oversimplifying, confusing, and politicizing, all in one simple sentence. Now, in the subject that was targeted by Bush, stem cell research, science really hasn't done itself a whole lot of favors. There's a scandal arising from fraud by infamous Korean researcher Woo Soon-hwang. That also implicates researchers in U.S. universities and even Science Magazine, which gives more fuel to the right to co-opt it as evidence to impugn the integrity of science and question the scientific process itself. And, you know, their argument goes, after all, with such internal strife in the scientific community, how can we trust the findings and recommendations? Something that the Bush administration and previous administrations have used this very much to their advantage to dispute any facts that have to do with global warming, since we don't have any scientific, agreement on global warming, then it must not exist, right? Yeah. Tell that to me when, Florida is gone, California might be gone, things like that. But anyway, I highly recommend this book to you. Again, it is called The Republican War on Science by Chris Mooney, and it is published by Basic Books. And it's out in hardcover right now. Another book review that we have a couple more minutes to talk about. This one is also quite chilling. Not only is it chilling, but the picture on it is quite creepy because it shows George and Laura Bush holding hands. And is she not one of the dowdiest first women you've ever seen? I think we're at the first woman thing, first lady. It's such a dumb thing. She's a really dowdy wife of a president with some bad clothes. Anyway, with God on their side, and it's how Christian fundamentalism trampled science, policy, and democracy in George W. Bush's White House. This book's by Esther Kaplan. It came out actually a couple years ago, 2004, in the New Press. So it might be out in soft cover right now, but I highly recommend that book, too. You know, you all know how they trot out the story of George W. Bush's religious awakening, how a tale of a hard drinker, alleged drug user, turned a pious Christian. You know, it's like the American feel-good story, you know, the God-fearing executive who once wallowed in sin. But if you look closer at that legend, there's a lot of flaws in the narrative. Now, Kaplan's book here, With God on Their Side, exposes the underbelly of the Bush administration, from justifying war by calling Islam a religion of violence to endangering teenagers by denying funding for school-based sex ed programs that mention contraception or abortion. It's a pretty terrifying book because it's full of those kind of examples. And her documentation in the book connects the dots and just demonstrates how Christian fundamentalism has intruded into every aspect of U.S. life. Now, if you start by just looking at W. himself, previous presidents have, you know, consistently affirmed, you know, that they believe in God. But W. has taken it one step further, and he talks about how he's got like a direct red phone, like the bat phone to God or something. When the president met with the then Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in 2003, he told him, "God told me to strike at Al-Qaeda, and I struck them. Then he instructed me to strike at Saddam, which I did, and now I am determined to solve the problem in the Middle East." I mean, what hubris, really. Problem in the Middle East is, you know, at least going back to, like, 1918 from some serious problems. You know, late 19th century from some issues with some immigration there. I mean, that problems in the Middle East go back way before W., but he's determined to solve those problems. And W. also mentioned God when he was talking about whether he's going to run for the White House. He announced, you know, "God wants me to run." And then after 9/11, he told Time magazine that God had chosen him to lead the world's war on terror. So, but not only does he believe that he's got divine approval and a hotline to God, but he also believes that his agenda, or the right-wing agenda, represents God's will. So God must be anti-abortion, anti-gay, scornful of the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty on Nuclear Arms, of course. And he, of course, no she, like the Bush administration, sees the United Nations as one step short of satanic internationalism. That's right, one world government. Ring any bells? One example there is, look at the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Now, the thought of ratification sends the Bush team into panic. To hear them tell it, the convention would require the United States to, and I'm quoting here, "hand over our right to decide our own laws on such issues as family law, parental rights, religious exercise, education, abortion regulation, employment pay scales, quotas in educational institutions, workplaces, elected offices, and forbid us from recognizing that men and women are fundamentally different." Wow, well, it's nice that the Bush team has just sort of set out for us all of the places in which discrimination against women resides. But it's too bad that they don't want to do anything about it. Now, it's interesting that Bush's posturing reeks of this anti-feminist backlash, and it's an overt reaction to the blurring of gender roles that the women's and the gay, lesbian, trans movement have trumpeted since Stonewall. But as horrifying as the rhetoric is, it's the policies that are worse. Now, take AIDS. I mean, this is old news now, but 20 years into it, we know that reducing the risk of infection by practicing safer sex and using clean needles cuts transmission. But this is not a message that we're going to promote. No, instead, there's still an all-out war on condoms, and it's previously been hinged on the fact that condoms didn't stop the human papilloma virus, and that myth was recently debunked, I think, within the last week. So it'll be interesting to see what the Bush administration's response is to it. Money for programs that promulgate abstinence as the only solution to STDs, including AIDS, is free-flowing. AIDS organizations that are critical of that stance have been published. 15 groups, for example, who are all previous recipients of federal funding, were subjected to months of intensive audits over the last couple of years. And those ranged in include the Gay Men's Health Crisis, the National Association of People with AIDS, and the Stop AIDS Project. Another similar tack is that Christian fundamentalists have come into public schools with curriculum that's been penned by religious right to teach abstinence to Americans' youth. And again, hundreds of millions of dollars of federal money have been made available for a host of projects. Kaplan quotes a guy named John Marble, National Stonewall Democrats, about his research into teen mania and other anti-sex efforts. He says the abstinence-only message is deeply linked with evangelical Christianity. You're really hoping that everybody's going to come to Christ and they're going to wait till marriage for sex. If you're struggling with homosexual thoughts, you need to convert to Christianity and that will cure you. And then there's abortion, of course, the religious right obsession. Bush's reinstatement of Mexico City policy, or global gag rule, prohibits U.S.-financed international family planning groups from performing abortions or counseling women about their options, even with funds that are raised separately. Even with funds raised separately. Now, it's so hypocritical because reducing family planning has caused a groundswell of abortions and increase in female death from illegal procedures. A Population Action International report notes that clinic closures in country after country have happened. In Kenya, 5 family planning clinics were shuttered after having their USAID funding cut off for refusing to comply with the policy. One of those facilities was the only center serving 300,000 people in a vast poor neighborhood of Nairobi. Sounds pretty absurd, but it comes directly from God through, of course, the bat phone to George W. Bush. So anyway, I highly recommend this book. Again, it's called With God on Their Side, How Christian Fundamentalism Trampled Science, Policy, and Democracy in George W. Bush's White House. It's by Esther Kaplan. And the other book that I reviewed today, which I highly recommend to you, Republican War on Science by Chris Mooney. So pick those up if you're at your local bookstore. And one more time, I want to recommend to you that you come down to check out the Blues Festival, or if you can't make it down there next Friday through Tuesday, be sure and tune into KBOO and listen to the live simulcast. And we're going to head out with a little bit more music from Kid Loco from Late Night Tales. And I think this track is by Status. It's called Uplink. Again, that's Kid Loco from Late Night Tales. This has been Boneheads and Bigots, and I will see you next month.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Be sure to tune in for more talk radio Monday morning at 7:30. Cecil's guest will be publisher and editor Victor Novasky, whose new book is A Matter of Opinion, a memoir about his years editing and publishing The Nation. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!